Good evening and welcome to the History Show and a programme given over to a field trip to an industrial estate in County Laois, leading to a journey through some of the most precious documents ever likely to be vested in the Irish state. Many of our regular listeners may remember a history show from October 2023, in which we highlighted the relative inaccessibility to the public and to scholars of the last great untapped archive of Irish social history, the records of the Land Commission, founded in 1881 and revamped on the creation of the Irish Free State in 1923. The archive contains up to 11 million documents in 23,000 boxes, material of potentially untold value to historians and genealogists that's currently stored in two facilities in Sandyford and Port Laoise in the care of the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. On that October programme we heard from, among others, historian Professor Terence Dooley, genealogist Fiona Fitzsimons and archivist Katrina Crowe. Here's a sample of what they had to say back then.
The Land Commission records are deemed to be personal records containing sensitive material, but unless you can actually view those records, it's difficult to say what exactly is sensitive. I would have thought the material in the military service pensions was much more sensitive than the material in the Land Commission records. There is a possible argument that the records of the collection branch could be sensitive. Those are the records of collection of annuities and payments, and they make up about 417 boxes. They might be deemed to be sensitive, and there is an argument for possibly putting those out of access to researchers. But the other records, I really cannot conceive what reason they could possibly give. All European privacy law applies only to living people. The people that are documented in these records, because the greater amount of Land Commission records date from 1891 to 1926, the greater number of the people in those records are long dead. So there really is no argument to be made on the basis of privacy that we shouldn't have access to these records.
I would say the Irish Land Commission represents the single most important archive available to social historians of Ireland, not just from the beginning of its working in 1881, but indeed because of the archives that it acquired from its predecessors, going all the way back in some cases to the 16th and the 17th century. But from the perspective of social historians, and remember, scholars from a wide variety of other disciplines, be it geography, sociology, anthropology, political science, and so on, these archives have such a wealth of information and detail to offer.
What's lacking is the will to even investigate this, to actually see what it might cost to do it, to investigate, are some of the records being used for legitimate working current purposes, and to see how these things might be made available to the public, at least some of them, if not all of them. That, to me, does not seem like a huge ask. It's never been done. It is, I'm afraid, the curse of a lot of what goes on in the public service these days, a sort of terminal apathy and lethargy that, oh, we'll do it tomorrow or it'll be grand in the future. It won't. These are important. And we would really benefit from having them right now or as soon as possible, considering all we've discovered about the recent decade of centenaries. This would add immeasurably to our understanding of that decade and, of course, of life in Ireland into the 20th century.
Theoretically, they're accessible on a case-by-case basis, but it's very arbitrary. I applied 3 times to use records. The first 2 times I was given the go-ahead. I was able to rock up. I was able to pull down the exact file box, pull out the exact document that I was looking for. The 3rd time I applied, permission was denied. No reason was given.
What it really needs is for the National Archives to take a very proactive stance on this, with the backing of its own department, which is the Department of Culture and Arts and all the other things it's a department for, to tell the Department of Agriculture that they are breaking the statute, the National Archives Act of 1986, and that that is against the law and they have to stop doing it and start dealing with this issue now. That has never happened. There has never been a really forceful approach to the department to not just ask them, but tell them that they've got to do this or they're in breach of the law. I'd love to see that happening. The other possibility, of course, is that access might be granted to the Virtual Repository of Ireland, Peter Crook's great adventure, where he's trying to restore what was lost in 1922. He did get access, I think, to indexes that may or may not be digitized because the person in charge of them, I think, has moved on. But even if some chink in the armor can be established by that project, and Peter seems to have fantastic persuasive powers, that would start the ball rolling and at least get us somewhere. If the indexes were digitized, we would have some idea, and the general public would have some idea of the enormity of the size of this collection and how valuable it could be for research.
I mean, over the last few years, certainly efforts are being made or have been made to catalogue the material. Of course, it would take a massive investment, I would think, of capital and human resources in order to put shape on these records, in order to make them available to a research public. But it would undoubtedly be one of the most important archival projects undertaken in this country.
Historian Professor Terence Dooley, genealogist Fiona Fitzsimons, and archivist Katrina Crowe on the difficulty of gaining access to the vast archive of the Irish Land Commission, the organisation initially responsible for the movement of farms from Irish landlords to their former tenants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and which then concerned itself from the 1920s with the redistribution of farmland throughout the country until it was finally dissolved, its work deemed to have been completed in 1999. On that programme, we didn't hear from the Department of Agriculture. That was because the History Show had been promised a visit to the facility and a tour of the archive. That took place in January. Apparently, our programme had not gone entirely unnoticed in the upper echelons of the department. Nonetheless, we received a very warm welcome and some positive news.
My name is John Kinsella. I am the head of legal services at the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. And as part of that role, I have policy and operational responsibility for the Irish Land Commission, including its records.
You've heard our programme before Christmas. Just in general terms, a response to some of the pleas or some of the criticisms that were enunciated, mostly by historians or by archivists in that programme.
It's a complicated story, anything to do with the Land Commission, but I suppose when it was dissolved in 1999, it had largely completed its strategic purpose, but the administrative work connected with the Land Commission work hadn't been completed. So the functions of the Land Commission had to transfer over to the Minister along with staff and along with the records that we have here. And the purpose of that transfer was to enable the Minister to complete the administrative work of the Land Commission. It wasn't, these records were not transferred to the department in order for it to operate a publicly accessible archive. At least that was the understanding of the staff at the time. So they would have referred to these as working documents, quite understandably so. I would have thought, Miles, that operated for quite a long time without much controversy or problems, which is why that persisted for a long time. But the position is a lot different today. The department is much more conscious now, I think, of the potential historical significance of much of the material that we have in this archive here. And for that reason, I mean, it's fully accepted in the department from the Minister and the Secretary General all the way down that there should be greater access to these records than is currently the case. We do identify with the fact that scholars want to come in here, and we have tried to accommodate academic access. So if people do require access to the records, we will do our best to facilitate that, particularly in recent years when we've become much more aware that this is more than just working documents for us. So in the last year or so, we've had about 10 requests for academic access, and we've granted all 10 requests. I mean, we come at that from a very positive with a positive approach. We want to try and help people, but we do it on a case-by-case basis at the moment. And again, that's down to logistics. We have a limited staff, we have a limited space, we have a lot of work to do already. So We will try and expand that in future when we get advice on how best to do that. But we very much relate to the fact that scholars want access to here, and we want to work with them and facilitate that as best we can. With that evolution in our thinking in relation to these records, coupled with the fact that the residual work of the Land Commission undertaken by the department is now at a very advanced stage, largely complete, now is the right time for us, we believe, to transfer all of the records here that are over 30 years old, which is by far and away the vast majority of these records, over to the National Archives, where they can be made publicly available and properly housed and safeguarded into the future. And we're working with and engaging with the National Archives to implement a plan that will bring that about. I suppose any restrictions on access that currently are in place at the moment, they're not going to continue indefinitely. They're there primarily at the moment, I think, to safeguard the integrity of these records. What we have here is an entirely paper-based archive. They're priceless records, which is why people like to get in and see them. And I mean, if they're lost or damaged, they're ultimately irreplaceable. So it's important to have restrictions on their access, at least until such time as we've really determined how to properly get more access to those records in a way that ensures their safekeeping into the future.
Now, I've just driven into this archive. It is a large building. You have something like 11 million records in there. We were chatting beforehand. You put it in perspective for me. The military service pension collection, 250,000 files. So this is basically 44 times the size of the military service pensions collection. I can imagine that the National Archive, on one hand, very happy to be negotiating with you and talking about the transfer of this material, but on the other hand, tearing their hair out and wondering, well, where are we going to store all this material? They're not going to be able to fit all this in Bishop Street, surely.
Well, I can't speak for the National Archives plans, but I can tell you that they are interested in this material. So we do have to figure out the logistics in relation to this. We're going to be procuring this year now, hopefully early in the year, specialist archival advice to help us implement a plan for the transfer over to the National Archives. And it'll really be for the National Archives to, I suppose, make sure that they have what they need to put in place in order to make these records available in the way that they usually would. Now, it's going to take a very long time, Miles. This is a massive undertaking. 8 to 11 million records, very complicated records. We're not talking A4, A5s. We're talking maps and all types of different records. So it is going to be a massive undertaking, and there will be an interim period where we ourselves here are going to have to find a way to try and make these records available to scholars and others in a bigger way than we currently do. But again, we're going to be getting advice in relation to how we do that. There's no great problem in principle with doing this. Everybody, I think, has agreed that there should be greater access to these records. But it is a question of logistics. This building that you're in now, for instance, it serves the department very well and the functions that it has these records for very well. But it was never procured, designed and developed with the public in mind. So we have to figure out a lot of logistical things before we can increase the access. So there will be a lot of work for the National Archives. It's not going to happen overnight, I wouldn't have thought, so we're going to have to work out some interim arrangements, and that will probably mean us beefing up our resources here, bringing in expertise that we don't currently have here in relation to archives. As I say, that all has to be worked out, and we're currently in the process of getting advice to help us and inform our way forward on all of these issues.
Now, I could be living in cloud cuckoo land, but can I mention the D word, digitization? Is that a prospect in any shape or form?
Well, again, to go back to the numbers, 8 to 11 million individual records, I don't think there's any real prospect of digitising all of the material that we have here. There may be a case to digitise some aspects of the collection here, in particular the finding aids, and that's something that we are likely to do ourselves for our own purposes. But it's just the scale of the collection here is just far, far bigger than anything, any other, like the military service pensions or all of these other collections that have been digitised would be completely dwarfed by our collection here. So it's something that we looked at and investigated with a view, again, primarily to trying to bring about access. Because why would you be digitizing these records? You'd be doing it to try and facilitate greater access to the records. But it would just take so, so long to do that. It's actually, there are more efficient ways of getting greater access to these records.
Perhaps some of the more delicate records could be digitised, the kind of records that you don't want people handling on a daily basis?
Yeah, we're going to procure, as I say, archival advice in relation to all of those matters. So I completely accept that there are some aspects of this collection that are likely to require digitisation. So that is true. But in terms of the entire collection, digitising it in the way that the military services pensions, for example, have been digitised, I don't think that's a runner, really.
But the bottom line is that historians, archivists, scholars, members of the public can expect in the years ahead that there will be greater access to this unique collection.
No, absolutely. And that's what the department wants, as I say, from the minister and the Secretary General down. That is very much the desire. It's just going to, we can all agree that that's where we need to get to. It's less clear how we get to that point. Some people will say you should do it by way of digitization. Some people suggest that we should have transferred this to Tailtea Éireann. Some people suggest that you should throw open the doors. So how we get to that point is the real sort of conundrum that we have to work out. But we're in the process of working it out. We'll get the advice, we'll inform our position. And what I'd like to really say is we will get to a point where we can improve access to these records, and we will do it in a responsible way, in a way that ensures that these records are properly safeguarded into the future for future generations.
The Land Commission archive is certainly being well looked after. The modern storage facility in which its files are housed and protected is in a large warehouse in Clonmynam Business Park on the outskirts of Port Leisha. But while the staff is hard working, dedicated, and conscious of the responsibility they bear for a collection of documents that contains much of the narrative of rural Ireland of the 19th and 20th centuries, there are only so many of them, and they're obliged to treat the archive mainly as a set of working documents to be searched when required by solicitors involved in the conveying of land. This process takes them to about 10% of the 23,000 file boxes each year, where, in addition to the files being sought to facilitate the buying and selling of land, a number of archival gems are discovered, entirely by accident. These are then extracted and carefully preserved. The truth is that no one knows exactly what this collection contains. There are hundreds of file boxes which must have remained untouched over the years because no relevant search requests have been received that would cause them to be opened. They sit on the metal shelving ready to reveal their secrets. The person with day-to-day responsibility for running this potential treasure trove took up his position just a few months ago.
Hi, I'm Mick Boylan. I'm the Assistant Principal Officer here in Records Branch, and I'm the Keeper of Records here in Port Leash.
Just tell me, first of all, in the most general possible terms, what have you got here?
What we have here is an archive of historic documents that are ranging of 23,500 boxes approximately. In each of these boxes, we have estate files. We have approximately 23,000 estate files. Some of the boxes would have maybe 5 to 6 estate files. However, some of the bigger estate files would have maybe 10 to 15 boxes associated with it. And in each box is totally unique and individual. You actually don't know what you're going to find in each box until we open them. And there is some boxes here that we actually haven't seen inside because the request has never come in to look for that information.
How far back does the material here go?
The earliest document we have found is back to June 1640. We have a lot of documents in the late 1600s, huge amount of documents in the 1700s, and then the vast majority is from 1890 onwards.
Historians, obviously, scholars want access to the material that you have here, but it is a working archive. Yeah. This material is being used on an annual basis, on a weekly basis, even on a daily basis. What kind of things happen here? Well, typically, what do you do on a daily basis here?
So on a daily basis, we get requests in from legal services, representative solicitors, and from members of the public looking for title documents, maps, vesting orders, Q1s, fiats. What this is relates to is if somebody is getting a mortgage and they have a site, or somebody is selling a piece of land or is looking for entitlement to maybe entitlement scheme or commonage for farming schemes. So it's a vast array of documents out there. So when we do a search, if the person is looking for an easy search, they have all their documentation in order, their folio numbers at the right, we're able to get turnover documents and the search in about an hour. However, for a search, for example, of maybe a solar farm or for someone that's putting in wind turbines, it could be across multiple land, multiple estates. So that search could take a couple of weeks to do. So our searches vary, and we get approximately 2,500 searches per year.
Now, I think of it as the Land Commission archive. It's obviously a lot more than that. But in what sense does this archive relate to the Land Commission, the commission that was re-established in 1923 and then dissolved in 1999, and the work that that Land Commission did?
Well, every document that we have here has come over from the Land Commission, has come over from when Bishop Street closed down. We took over in 1999 and we migrated down here to Portlaoise in about 2007 into a state-of-the-art, a controlled environment and facility here in Portlaoise.
And tell me about the conditions in which this archive is kept, because some of it, as you say, is centuries old.
Yeah. So of all the different documents are all in fireproof and waterproof boxes. We are a controlled environment of 19 degrees, so we're controlled during the summer and during the winter. And it's very important because some of the documents are skins and vellums that haven't been opened in a couple of hundred of years. So even for us to go search these documents, we have to treat them with extreme care, because we can't just open a document and fold it out. We have to peel back the skin literally and open them with extreme care and caution, you know.
And are you still finding new treasures? Are you still finding stuff that you didn't know was there?
Yeah, every day we find. We have one person here, he's 17 years here, and only 2 weeks ago he opened one box and he found a document relating to the Commissioner of Woods going back to 1829 in a canister. He'd never seen one of those before, and it just shows that no matter what box we open, we never know what we're going to find when we open the box here.
If the archive is transferred to the National Archive, will you miss it?
Oh yes, the job here is fantastic. Like, it's when you walk out there, you go, "What am I going to find today?" Like, it's just a fantastic place to be, because everything is actually a new experience. Not just from the daily standards of looking for our normal job, what we're looking for here, but to discover something. And we're always looking. We have a little thing here to see who has something back to further. So it's great to see who can discover something rare. And every little gem is great out there.
The longest-serving employee in the archive is Tommy Heffernan, who's been scouring the records section on behalf of the buyers and sellers of Irish land for almost 20 years. Every now and again, he comes across an unexpected gem, but the process is entirely serendipitous. If he finds anything exceptionally significant, it's purely pot luck. Mick and Tommy had laid out a few of their more interesting "Here's One I Found Earlier" diamonds for us to consult.
My name is Tommy Heffernan. I work with the Records Branch in Portlaoise, the Irish Land Commission.
Tommy, you've been here for what, 17 years?
That's correct, man.
So you are more familiar than most, or more familiar than anybody else with the material, but still full of surprises. What are you holding in your hand?
This is a purchase agreement. You can see it's the name of Douglas Taheed on the front. It's County Roscommon. It's from the Dufresne estate, vesting a portion of land in Douglas Hyde. To be given to him by the Land Commission. So possibly his ancestors would have been tenants on the estate previous to that, and that's the way the Land Commission worked. They left the tenants mostly intact. We can have a look inside it.
And this is French Park in County Roscommon, which is associated with, well, it's associated with Percy French as well, but it's also associated with Douglas Hyde.
So we can see he received 4 acres and 2 acres in this townland of Clunmangunan, I think is the name of there. And we can see the various denuities that would be payable now back to the Land Commission on a twice yearly basis. Denuities mostly fall the same as the Gael days.
That'd be in May and November.
Exactly, correct, yes. We can see here the name here.
Written in beautiful handwriting. Yes, well, spidery correct. Handwriting. Oscoelge Douglas Taheed.
Yes. Occupation.
Uchtaron. Postal address, Arason Uchtaron.
Arason Uchtaron, correct.
This would have been sometime in the 1940s that he would have acquired these 6 acres, but it all relates back, it still relates back in this document to 1903 and to the Wyndham Land Purchase Act.
Exactly, because it was 1942 by the time that he was granted this piece of land.
And the other interesting thing about this document is that this is not something that you've been aware of for the last 17 years. This is
correct.
You've only just come across this.
We've come across it, but it's by chance that we come across some rather famous items that we wouldn't be aware of, because, as a past colleague of mine said, there's some boxes here that will be never opened. Unless there's a query or an inquiry into the contents of them, we wouldn't be going near them.
So that's how you found this?
Yes, that's how we found this.
Just completely by accident?
Just completely by accident, yes.
Wander over here for a moment, and we're looking at a very, very old document here, and a huge, huge wax seal, which is literally tied onto this document. That's with a piece of string. Can you explain what we're looking at here?
This would be the charter, I suppose you could call it, where the monarchy of England would have given the landlords the large tracts of land, because some of the estates would be, could be up to 100,000 acres. Some of the local ones would be 40,000 acres and smaller, of course. And most of these landlords that got them would have served the crown as members of the judicial service, or they would be soldiers or army officers or naval officers or whatever. So this was the reward.
Just describe that seal for me. I mean, there seem to be, I don't know what they are, military characters that looks like somebody in the middle sitting on a throne of some kind?
This looks like the monarch in the middle, possibly bodyguards or something just beside him, or servants. We'd also have a rear end, a rear side on this.
Okay, you're just turning it over for me now. Man on a horse.
Yes, the monarch on the horse, whatever monarch would be on the throne at a particular time.
So this is George the Third. So this is Mad King George, basically. This is a gift from Mad King George of Irish land to somebody.
To somebody, yes.
Beside the seal is a rather scruffy-looking document, which is of major significance. Just you're opening it very, very carefully because it's extremely old. What have we here?
Miles, we're not quite sure what this is. We know it's dated 1640, and some of the writing is very, very hard to make out.
I see the name David Jones. That doesn't necessarily mean anything. A pretty common name, I would have thought.
Same with David Jones. To all
Christian people.
Christian people.
We're needing a magnifying glass now to read this. The writing is very small.
It's very small, and it's actually worn there in the centre.
So this is 1640. So this is before the 1641 rebellion, before the arrival of Cromwell.
Exactly, yes.
And apparently, is this now the oldest document that you think you have in this collection?
I found one in the past. It was 1313.
What was that about?
Again, it was very hard to make out the writing. It was very hard to read. I think this one is fairly worn. This was twice as well worn. So it was very hard to indicate what. I suppose if you had it under magnifying glass, you could draw some information from it, but it was actually impossible to read. But
so it was something to do with land transfer.
It's something down there, but a needle in a haystack. But sometime, hopefully, we will come across it again.
And this, even though it's one of the oldest documents in your collection, again, was only discovered very recently.
Very recently, that's correct, yeah. Yeah, we would have a lot of documents because we would have a lot of people looking for, if there's a fee farm grant indicated under purchase agreement, they'd be asking about fee farm grants. So some of those could go back to maybe 1640 or that era. And sometimes we will find them, and more times you come across a little brown envelope which says finally delivered. So that indicates to us that the landlord's solicitor or whoever took up the practice would have requested the document back for some reason. A lot of estates would still contain the fee farm grants, birth certs, death certs, marriage settlements, intermarriage settlements. So there's a lot of stuff relating back even before 1881, when the Land Commission was established.
So in solicitors' offices around the country, documents like this could still be stored somewhere?
Oh, it's very possible, yes, yes.
While the Land Commission archive is a potential treasure trove for historians, genealogists and other researchers, that is not its primary purpose at the moment. It can also be a vital resource in the process of conveyancing. The records section in Portlaoise gets hundreds of requests each year from solicitors representing clients who are buying and selling land. We were allowed to follow the course of one such search without obviously knowing the identity of the principals involved. Tommy Heffernan grabbed a random requisition and took me on a quest. It involved a lot of cross-referencing, the combing of boxes and drawers, and believe me, it took considerably longer than what you're about to hear. So we're now entering the Holy of Holies.
Yes, we're entering our ledger room here now. This is what we do on a daily basis. And we see it's from a solicitor representing a client, and they have indicated that their client is the owner of this folio. We can see it's a County Meath folio. The first thing we do is we search in a number of volumes, about 24 of these volumes, they're called scheduled books. So we're looking for schedule 14028. So if we open up this book, conveniently it's on the front page here, 14028, and we can see it's from the estate of Fowler.
So that would have been the landlord at some point?
Yeah, correct, yes.
So 1915 is the column?
Yes. What we'd be concerned now is finding this on the Fowler estate under this record number. So the next step then, we're armed with the estate name and we have the record number here. So then we have to go down and we find the box numbers. These are our quick reference books here.
And again, these are ledgers, large ledgers. Yes. And
these ones here, the State Commissioner's Round, about 1903.
So the 1903 Wyndham Land Purchase Act, which essentially divested landlords of pretty much all of the remaining land in their hands, almost all, not quite all, but almost all of the remaining land in their hands over a period of better part of 20 years, I suppose.
So we're looking for EC 4903, so it gives a box 3014. We're actually going upstairs.
We're going upstairs, all right. I didn't even know there was an upstairs. So essentially, you only find material, like some of the material you've shown me, when somebody makes a request and you go and you consult, you open a box and you find hopefully what you're looking for, but you may get a dividend, you may find some other extraordinary material.
Well, that's correct, yes. You're going to find the document that you're after, but you could find something else as well.
Phase two of the operation took us deeper into the archive, to a storehouse with hundreds of shelves, thousands of files, and the hum of air conditioning. Again, you can hear the industrial sound of air conditioning in the background. And we have a long, long, long corridor with lots and lots of shelves. I'm going to follow you.
Shelves and boxes on either side.
Some of these boxes are wooden boxes. Some of them are metal boxes.
We're changing out of the metal boxes into those fireproof boxes for the safety of the documents. So
we're in the relevant section here, 3000.
We're up here.
So this is a metal box.
Yes. If we put out this agreement here, we can see we had a folio of 5103. This is the particular document that we require. And then what we do is we take this up and we go up to our map trays and we look for EC 4903.
So we're not finished yet?
Oh no, we're not finished yet. We can see a little small snippet about the landlord in particular. He was a former captain in Her Majesty's Army.
This is a very small farm. You're talking about just over 6 acres.
Oh, it's tiny. It's very small, yes. Of course, we can see the insignia here of the Irish Land Commission under the crown. The embossment's done rather as when Sarah Darren took over in 1823, as the harp was embossed.
But this only takes us now somewhere else, does it?
We'll get a map for this now and that'll complete the search. This will give an indication on the ground of what it looks like. So we're looking for 4903. So this is, we can see they're done in numerical order here.
Yeah, they're very, very old. What material are those maps actually drawn on? This doesn't look like paper.
The maps are drawn on paper. There's a backing put on them. We actually have some of them here. And when I was in Bishop Street, we used to actually iron this backing on. It comes in a big roll and you get down with your normal iron and iron it on. Iron it on. Yes, there's some sort of a substance in it, and when it's hit by the heat, it actually adheres to the paper. First of all, we open up our purchase agreement. And we're looking for the townsland of Rathmylan and Glebe. So, let's turn our maps
down. Beautiful old Ordnance Survey map. This is, I think, presumably it's a 6-inch map, is it?
It would, yes. The red line here indicates the border of the estate, and those green lines internally indicate the individual plots.
There's something very interesting there. Labourer's plot.
Yes, the labourer's plot, yes. Most of the labourer's plots, when we come to the Land Commission, we would have, some of them would be excluded from being taken up because they would have been probably vested out previously by the landlord. So this wouldn't be an unusual thing to find on some of the maps. Here we can see the townsend of Rathmylan. See, this particular tenant got plot 17 in Rathmylan. So we actually search around the map and look for plot 17, but
it's very small.
It's very small. There's a blow-up of the map here. So there's the 17 there. So it's
It's actually a house and garden, or exactly, a house and it's a kitchen
actually,
garden.
It's actually in this little area here. So this is a blown-up version of it. So we have plot 17.
So that's in the village of Rathmoylan.
Now we're searching for plot 1, the glebe, 6 acres. Glebe is down here.
It's just southwest of the village of Rathmoylan.
And here we can see plot 1. We photocopy this version of the purchase agreement and the equivalent map, and that's dispatched to the client then. And
so basically this was handed over by a landlord to a tenant in 1915.
Well, the Irish Land Commission would have been involved in the handover initially as well. Some of the states were, there was direct sales between landlords and tenants, with the Irish Land Commission acting as an arbitrator to make sure the fair rent, of course, and everything else that Michael Davitt had looked for in 1879 was adhered to. And some of the states then we see where the Irish Land Commission will have bought them and revested them in the existing tenants.
The Land Commission records, in theory at least, should contain mostly documentation relating to the transfer of property from landlord to tenant in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and thereafter the reallocation and redistribution of land by the independent Irish state. However, as we've already seen, there's simply no telling what will emerge when a box is opened. While we were still upstairs, Mick Boylan drew my attention to an odd-looking metal tube about 30 centimetres high and 5 across. He opened it to reveal a very beautiful and ornate document in perfect copperplate handwriting, which had somehow found its way into one of the boxes and, like so much else, had been discovered by accident.
This is a tube that we found in one of the boxes. It goes back to 1829 and it's for the Commissioner of Woods. What the Commissioner of Woods is, I'm not exactly sure, but it's done in 3 different vellums that are signed off as skin number 1, skin number 2 and skin number 3. This relates to forestry outside of Road in Offaly. We could be done a bit of research on it. But this is another example of something that was only found recently. It was only found just before Christmas when searching for another item in a box. And it's the one and only metal-tubed Commissioner Woods document that we actually have found. And you can see the seals and signatures on the back. And it was received for, in the pounds, of £2,925 back in 1829, which would have been a considerable amount of money back then.
While the Land Commission archive, when it does become more accessible, will be mostly the domain of academic historians and professional genealogists, it does contain thousands of family narratives and could become an invaluable resource for local and household historians. Tommy Heffernan, for example, has already chanced in his workplace upon elements of his own family history. You've just opened up a box. I'm not quite sure what exactly is in it, but you're going to tell me. You're looking at a big, big poster. Redcastle, Mount Rath, extensive sale of land. All of that in huge lettering.
Actually, it's from my home place, a place called Redcastle, just about 3 miles outside Mount Rath. And we can see where it was actually advertised for sale, part of the Coote estate, the famous Ballyfin house, which now a top-class hotel. Previously, it was owned by the Patrician Brothers. It was a very successful boarding school. And we see there's 2 lands here containing 293 acres. Just a step forward on that, we have down here.
So this looks like a deed of some kind.
Yes, this is an order vesting the lands in the Irish Land Commission. My grandfather, Thomas Heffernan.
Purchaser Thomas Heffernan.
Yes. Would have been a tenant. He was a herdsman on the estate. This was done around 1909. There were a number of sitting tenants on it. There was a large portion of it owned by the Mount Rath Urban District Council. And the next step is we can see from here where it fell under the Soldiers and Sailors Act. 2 of these guys, I actually knew them when I was a young fella. But after they were demobbed after the 1418 war, they came back home. Most of them would have been, as far as I know, volunteers or reservists, because my own grandfather was a full-time soldier. He was a sergeant in the Connacht Rangers, and he went on to England then. And we can see in the scheme there, they would have been farm labourers and so forth. So that's where the Irish Land Commission came in with the Soldiers and Sailors Act, and these people would have been provided, after they came back from France or wherever, with a soldier's and sailor's house. It's a specially designed house, it's a good slated house, narrowable holding of about 20 acres, which was a decent farm at that time. And of course they would have received a small pension as well.
Okay, so you're opening a huge folio, which is a list of names,
yes,
down the left-hand side, and then lots of information in different columns to the right of that, and a map.
Yes,
the map. Estate, Queen's County, estate of Sir R.A. Coote.
Yes, and these would be all the plots. These would be crossing into another town then called Ringstown. We can see the scheme here, it's very descriptive of different tenants, how much land they got, and this man was married with a wife and three children, stock one cow and a calf in a house. These were ordinary tenant farmers.
Now you've just turned a page, and at the at the bottom of this page is forces in the war, forces in the war. So presumably these were the plots that were given to the demobbed veterans.
Correct, yes. We can see where they entered the theatre of war, where they served, what regiments they were in. And we can see this man here, section 1, 1919, he joined in 1917, so he had about a year of service, and he was actually attached to the London Yeomanry. You can see this man down here entered in 1914, and he served in the Leinster Regiment. This gentleman here is in South Irish Horse, so he was there literally from the start, and he served in France and Belgium again. As we see the description here, he was a labourer on his father's farm, so farming was, I suppose, in his veins, and it was great that the Land Commission came on board and gave people like this houses and of course land as well. One guy here who's actually wounded and gassed.
There's a note here, has £200. They've actually checked him out and he has a bank account.
Oh yes, well some of the inspectors were very descriptive of what, like this man here is £70.
£70,
and,
yeah.
And they were fairly, and this man has £200 again. So it was a fairly decent sum at the time, I suppose.
Pretty intrusive. And,
very intrusive, yes. I suppose they had to maybe, I don't know whether they had to expose their means or whatever. It's interesting stuff. And actually, there are a good few schemes in some of the states. We come across them by accident most of the time, but here a number of years ago there was a young fellow doing his thesis and I was given the job of going around with him, and we discovered 14 estates, but some of the inspectors went into great detail. They actually give the army service number for people that were doing military research. Absolutely wonderful.
Although some of the gems of this collection have already survived for centuries, there's still an element of urgency about conserving the contents of these 23,000 boxes. It was apparent from our random search with Tommy Heffernan that many of the files in the collection have seen better days, a fact acknowledged by John Kinsella as we studied the contents of the box from which the much-prized and still mysterious 1640 documents had come.
Yeah, well, it's very disorganised, Miles. It's obviously, we can see it's some very old documents. There's no real order to the documents, and we don't know what's in there. So we would have to catalogue all of these documents. We'd have to take them out, clean them, conserve them. None of that work has been done on these documents. And as I stress, just, you know, not all like this, but a lot will be very similar. So, yeah, there's a lot of work that has to be undertaken before we can get this material out to the public, I suppose.
It's exciting, but it is a headache.
Well, it's certainly a lot of work.
And that, if anything, is an understatement. There are thousands of boxes to be opened, explored, conserved, catalogued, and then curated into the future. This will require time, lots of it. It will require patience, cooperation between the Department of Agriculture and the National Archives, and plenty of resources. But it will be well worth the effort, and let's be under no illusions, the considerable expense. Because within the confines of this modest business park warehouse is contained so much of the social history of Flann O'Brien's plain people of Ireland, and not just rural Ireland either. Because of the vast encroachment of our towns and cities onto the country's green spaces, and the scale of building on agricultural land over the last century, there's an urban narrative playing out somewhere in these files as well. The effort to make them available to one and all may even dwarf the scale of the operation that has delivered the story of the decade of centenaries to our computer screens via the Bureau of Military History Witness Statements and the Military Service Pensions Collection. However, while those admirable projects opened up narratives with short and clearly defined chronological parameters, The contents of the Land Commission archive constitutes a story for the ages. Access to and ownership of land was an Irish preoccupation long before any cogent struggled for independence. Merely conserving this collection and making it available in situ, wherever the archive finally comes to be located, is logistically and intellectually on a par with the digitization of the 1901 and 1911 census returns. That's it from the History Show for this week. The programme is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.